is the United States versus Amoli. Mr. Bendig? How close am I on the pronunciation? All right.
May it please the court. Raymond Bendig, counsel for Adesokan Amoli. Adene Adesokan. Mr. Adesokan, of course, is appealing his 78-month sentence.
Could I ask you just to speak up a bit? That device only records, it doesn't amplify.
Certainly, Your Honor. Okay, I thought I was picking up my own voice. Your Honor, Your Honors, Mr. Adesokan is of the opinion that his sentence was unlawful under 18 U.S.C. 3742A1. And his primary concern is the disparity of his sentence vis-a-vis his co-defendant that was sentenced earlier in time, Davis Amoli.
If we were to agree with the government that Mr. Davis's 12-month sentence is unreasonable, then where would that leave Mr. Adesokan's sentencing challenge? Because his sentence, Mr. Adesokan, that is, was within the guidelines range. And under Rita, we may presume that it was reasonable. You know, what is there that might overcome that presumption?
Well, Your Honor, I'm not familiar with Rita, but based on my research, comments made by a panel of this court in Boscarino in 2006, I cited the Eli decision from 1983. It is my opinion, based on my research, that the lack of explanation regarding the disparity from Judge Guzman gives rise to an inference that he did not apply his discretion properly. So
I think
the presumption is actually the opposite way. That without an explanation, we have similarly situated defendants, if not virtual twins, with the same charge. And without explanation from the trial court as to why there was a disparity, that gives rise to an inference that the court did not properly apply its discretion.
But I'm repeating my question. If we were to agree with the government that Mr. Davis Amoli's sentence was unreasonable, what happens to your argument?
I think it's still there because my client, interestingly, was sentenced to the maximum under the guidelines, and I think that's very telling. He was sentenced to 78 months, the guideline range being 63 to 78 months. He was given no benefit of his cooperation with the government, although there was no plea agreement presented to the trial court. Mr. Adesokan opted to take a pass on the plea agreement. And with the guidelines being merely advisory, certainly the trial court could have given him some benefit to his many proffers with the federal agents and with the U.S. Attorney's Office and his grand jury testimony. Such was requested at sentencing and was not done. So it's even if this panel were to decide that Mr. Davis Amoli's sentence was unreasonably low, it is still so wildly disparate from that of Mr. Adene Adesokan that his sentence is still unreasonable as well. What should Mr. Amoli's sentence have been? That's a rhetorical question. But it is so disparate to Mr. Adesokan's that I don't think that actually hurts Mr. Adesokan's.
Why do you think that these sentences were so wide apart? What do you think the reason is?
I don't know, Your Honor. They're virtual twins. Mr. Davis Amoli's criminal history, his criminal category was slightly lower, but his offense conduct was higher, such that under the sentencing guidelines, they each fell into a sentencing range of 63 to 78 months. Mr. Davis Amoli was sentenced in February of last year, was allowed to remain at liberty for 1 month. A few months later, Mr. Adesokan, having to a certain extent relied as a barometer on Mr. Omole's sentence, showed up for his sentencing hearing, received the maximum, and was immediately taken into custody. They're virtual twins. And I don't know what to attribute it to. And then, 1 month after Mr. Adesokun filed his brief in January of this year, the third defendant, Samuel Amole, was sentenced to 6 months under his guideline range. And it's just, I don't have an explanation for that.
They, obviously, they weren't joined. This was not a...
They all pled.
They all pled, but they weren't joined in the same...
Separate
process.
Sentencing hearings. The time that Mr. Adonai Adesokun was sentenced, Mr. Samuel Amole was set for trial approximately 1 month later, ended up pleading guilty. Mr. Adesokun is the only one who cooperated with the government, testified before the grand jury, sat for many proffers, opted not to sign a plea agreement, and yet received what we submit as an excessive sentence. Okay. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Bendick. Mr. Brayman?
Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm Paul Brayman. I represent Sam O'Malley. Your Honors, I don't have much more to say other than what I said in my brief, but one thing I want to stress is the two separate kind of schemes that we have in this case. Davis O'Malley and Mr. Adesokun were heavily involved and initiated this eBay scheme. My client got credit card information from his brother Davis O'Malley, ended up charging three cell phones and some merchandise with Abercrombie and Finch. And he's drawn in now to this overall eBay conspiracy on the theory that he got phones to aid this conspiracy.
Well, as I understand it, Mr. Brayman, he provided phones and identities that his co-defendants used to perpetrate the eBay portion of the scheme, and he evidently was familiar with one or more of the mail drops and false identities that they used.
Judge, I don't think that's true. The probation officer and the government painted in a broad brush on page 2 of the government's brief, they say that Davis O'Malley, and along with the defendant, stole identities. There's not one iota evidence that Sam ever stole any identity. He used identities that were stolen by Davis. But I would challenge them to come before this court and name one person whose identity Sam stole.
Well, didn't Mr. Adesokun testify that he was a participant in the eBay portion of the scheme as of December 2003?
No, not what he said, that Sam activated cell phones under the name of William Bergen. Mr. Adesokun proffered that, I think, to the government, testified before the grand jury. Other than that testimony or his saying that Sam did that, there is absolutely no proof of that, no phone records. And if you look at the record from a common sense standpoint, we know that Sam in October of 2004 did purchase three telephones fraudulently at a place he was working. Nothing, there's no involvement of Sam from that October 2004 going back to December of 2003 when Adesokun said he activated phones for this conspiracy. Sam doesn't do anything during that period, but in October of 2004, that's when his activity starts. He buys the three phones, he charges things using the bogus information that he gets from Davis.
Of course, it's a pure credibility issue, isn't it?
I don't think so, because Adesokun, which Judge Guzman found was a liar at one point.
But then he found his testimony to be credible.
Yeah, he says, you know, that's enough to give him these thousands and thousands of dollars of relevant conduct, you know, from that period of time when the record shows that Sam wasn't involved at all, no activity. no records about these phones being activated, nothing to substantiate Addis Hokins. And I think that's just clear error for him to pile that relevant conduct onto Sam. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Brayman. Ms. Sorensen?
May it please the Court, Juliet Sorensen on behalf of the United States. With respect to Mr. Addis Hokin, Addis Hokin's argument, ladies and your honors, misstates the case law as it applies to sentencing disparities among co-defendants. As the Court is aware, it is well established that the kind of disparity with which 18 U.S.C. 3553A is concerned is an unjustified difference across judges or districts and not among defendants within a single case. Now, in this case, the disparity among these co-defendants is unwarranted, but Davis Amali's unreasonable sentence is not a basis on which to vacate Mr. Addis Hokin's reasonable sentence. Mr. Addis Hokin and Davis Amali were similarly situated young men, as defense counsel stated, who committed the same crime and had similar backgrounds and criminal histories. Neither accepted responsibility for their conduct as reflected by the probation office, and both violated their conditions of release.
Ms. Sorensen, is it the government's position that any below-guideline sentence would be unreasonable for Davis Amali?
No, Your Honor. That is not the government's position in light of Booker. Reasonableness is a range, and it is a range that has to be justified in light of factors considered in 3553A. It is the government's position that in this case, the egregiousness of Davis Amali's conduct was such that it was not justified by the factors set forth by the district court judge. These factors included youth. Youth may be a permissible factor to consider when determining a sentence, but in this case, a case where the scheme was involved, it was lengthy, there were many victims, it was perpetrated over years, and it was conceived by Davis Amali and Addis Hokin when they were in high school. The defendant's youth does not reflect his naivete or lack of criminal history.
What, if anything, will the record tell us about the murder of the Amali's father and the impact that might have had on Mr. Davis Amali that potentially might have justified a below-guideline sentence?
Judge, I believe that the record indicates in the pre-sentence investigation report that Davis Amali's father had been murdered several years prior to the inception of this crime in Nigeria. Davis Amali himself never mentioned this to the probation officer. It was his mother who did. Davis Amali himself described himself as energetic, curious, and cool. And it's the government's position that the murder of his father, while clearly an unfortunate event, is not a reasonable basis to reflect the factors cited by the district court in deciding to impose a sentence of 12 months on the fraud count.
Ms. Sorensen, do you think it's advisable for this court to await the Supreme Court decision in Gaul?
Your Honor, I don't believe that the government's position is incorrect if the Supreme Court rejects the government's position in Gaul, because the reasonableness analysis remains. Yes, this was an extraordinary deviation, absent extraordinary circumstances. Nonetheless, even if the Eighth Circuit decision in Gaul is vacated, that reasonable analysis remains in place, and the factors that I've discussed, the age, the youth, the rehabilitative potential, which does not appear to exist, are factors cited by the district court judge that have no basis in fact.
We've got a maximum under the guidelines sentence, and then this extraordinary departure, or what used to be called a departure, on the other side. What explains that?
Judge, there is no reasonable explanation. As I stated earlier, I believe that the guideline sentence, Adesokan's sentence, is entitled to a presumption of reasonableness, and that Davis Amali's sentence, again, in very similar circumstances, is the grossly unreasonable sentence. I think that with respect to Davis Amali, the lack of criminal history cited by the district court judge is not correct. It was as extensive, although he was not in the same criminal history category as Mr. Adesokan. And he failed, like Mr. Adesokan, Davis Amali failed to demonstrate any significant rehabilitative potential that would justify that extraordinary deviation down to 12 months.
Well, the court, it's certainly a very interesting sentencing, but it seems as if he did think that Davis had gotten good grades in high school and was enrolled in college, and there had to be, this 24 mandatory consecutive, and that he had potential to rehabilitate himself, he didn't find that the criminal history category of Roman numeral 2 overstated the prior criminal record, and in his written in the court's subsequent written statement, his reasons for departure probably reflect a better attempt to justify the reduced sentence, but it certainly didn't sound as if the judge was going this way when you read the kinds of things that he said at the sentencing.
That's correct, Your Honor. And indeed, the facts pertaining to the defendant's conduct, his lying under oath at his revocation hearing, among others, were so egregious that the judge acknowledged them on the record before he inexplicably imposed a sentence that was unreasonable in light of those facts. With respect to defendant's intelligence, as I noted in my brief, intelligence in and of itself is not necessarily a reason for departure or indeed for rehabilitative potential, particularly in light of a scheme that requires such a high degree of involvement and indeed intelligence as this one did. With respect to the court's having to impose the consecutive 24-month sentence, that, too, was not a reason to impose a sentence of 12 months on the fraud count. Congress was concerned in enacting 18 U.S.C. 1028A, just as they were in enacting 18 U.S.C. 924C, as this court acknowledged in United States versus Roberson, with the ultimate result of the sentence. And the effect in this case was to undermine congressional intent, because both in this case and in Roberson, the district court judge looked at the total package that resulted and manipulated the ultimate result to reach a number that is unreasonable in light of the record. If I might briefly respond to the arguments raised by Samuel Amali's counsel. Samuel Amali knowingly contributed to the scheme's success by providing cell phones and identifiers to Davis Amali, his brother, and to Adesokan. This was a factual determination by the district court judge that was not clearly erroneous, especially, as Judge Rovner acknowledged, in light of the substantial record that was before the district court at that time. The district court correctly determined the date of the defendant's involvement based on the grand jury testimony and previous statement of Adesokan, and this determination is reviewed for an abuse of discretion that the district court did not commit in this case. He discussed Addis Okon's reliability on the record, his extensive self-incrimination in the grand jury, the details he gave, and he noted defendant Samuel Amoli's opportunity to rebut that evidence. Finally, Your Honor, with respect to the argument raised by Davis Amali's counsel about the ex post facto law and its application to count 9, the ex post facto clause does not prevent the application of 18 U.S.C. 1028A to the scheme. The ex post facto clause is at its core about notice. And the defendant, Davis Amali, was deemed to be on notice as of July 2004 when 1028A was enacted. The conduct that he is being punished for, the conduct to which he pled guilty, happened after the enactment of 18 U.S.C. 1028A. Moreover, the ex post facto clause is not violated when criminal conduct begins before but continues after the enactment of a new statute. And in this case, the scheme ran from April 2003 until at least, according to the indictment, June 2005. 1028A was enacted on July 15, 2004. There are no further questions, Your Honors. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Anderson?
May it please the Court, I'm Kent Anderson with the Federal Defender's Office of the Central District of Illinois, representing the appellee, Davis Amoli. Sounds kind of strange to say appellee, but... Mr. Amali.
First, I didn't recognize you. I thought you were at the wrong table.
I thought the same thing.
Good to see you either way, but
thank you. In this case, Mr. Amoli's 3-year sentence for his fraudulent scheme was reasonable and light, under the light standard of review, which this court employs after Booker, due to the facts of his youthful immaturity, likelihood of rehabilitation after his first substantial involvement with the law, which the court found the potential for rehabilitation would be destroyed by a much longer sentence. And, of course, there's the effect of the murder of his father. And, you know, as a student, he not only maintained a 3.25 grade point average in high school while on the football and chess teams, but then went on to community college.
And while perpetrating this...
Well, unfortunately,
amazingly sophisticated crime.
That's unfortunately correct, Your Honor. But it is still similar to the factors which this court found sufficient in United States v. Baker, where the court paid close attention to the defendant's lack of criminal history, his relatively young age, and his history of higher education and employment.
Do you think the sentence would have been any different? The sentences would have been any different if they'd all been sentenced at the same time?
I have no idea, Your Honor. It's possible. I would like to hope not, but it, you know, that would just be speculation on my part.
I'm trying. I've asked this question. Why this wide range of sentence?
Just following up on what Judge Kenney said, does the record in the sentencing reflect any reference to the earlier sentencing? I mean, do we have any reference in the latter sentencing to the earlier one? Just as a point of reference.
Well, okay. Frankly, in preparing for this, I didn't read Mr. Adesokan's sentencing transcript. Mr. Amoli was sentenced first.
Yeah.
I also, of course, haven't read his pre-sentence report, so I don't know what the precise differences were between the two.
There was like this unbelievable turn in the courtroom. I mean, the judge says, look, this fraud was substantial, it was involved, sophisticated, there are many, many victims, the defendant is arrogant, the defendant displays no empathy for any of his victims. He continued participating in the fraud after he's arrested, and charged in the state his behavior is contemptuous of the court, and there's a strong possibility that he's going to offend again. And then he says, but, I mean, it's pretty amazing.
True. On the cold record, it looks rather strange. However, it's not all that unusual for a district court to give somebody a stern lecture and at the same time they're giving them a break to basically say, hey, I'm giving you a break this time for these reasons, but your conduct is reprehensible and you won't get a break again. Unfortunately, that often doesn't look too good on appeal where all we have to read is the record.
Yeah.
And even assuming the disparity between the two was error, if Mr. Arasokan was sentenced too harshly, that doesn't mean that Mr. Amoli's sentence should be reversed. Of course, the government pointed to the criminal history differences. Most of this was part of the same scheme. The only other thing was driving on a revoked license. Therefore, this court should affirm Mr. Amoli's sentence as a proper exercise of the district court's discretion. And in the alternative, if this court isn't too sure that the reasons were sufficient, it should simply hold that the sentence could be reasonable and remand to the district court for a more thorough explanation of its reasons for the sentence.
All right.
But I would suggest that this court also hold it and wait for Gall and see what the Supreme Court does there. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Anderson. Mr. Brayman, you had reserved a minute. Not constitutionally mandated to use it all, either.
And I've never sat at that table.
I understand.
I would have fainted.
Pardon me?
I would have fainted.
Just addressing Mr. Arasokan's credibility before the grand jury, Judge Guzman at the sentencing hearing asked me, said something, well, you have to give me something why he would be lying, and I indicated that he was cooperating with the government. He had every reason to put this on Sam O'Malley. And when you take, and I noticed Ms. Sorensen didn't accept my challenge to come up with some identity that Sam had stolen, because there wasn't anything. But when you talk about almost a year period where there's absolutely no evidence of Sam involvement, it's just highly unreasonable to take that period of time and say Sam was part of the scheme. And I would ask you to reverse that sentence.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.